For the dark energy, the story was the universe is expanding, and it's accelerating in its expansion, and that requires an equation of state which has something unusual compared to dark matter and to ordinary matter. Negative pressure would do it. The vacuum would give you negative pressure. So as far as observations go, vacuum energy could be what you're looking at when you look at dark energy. And that led to the story that we should be able to calculate the vacuum energy, if that's right. And the problem was that it seemed like you couldn't quite calculate. You can calculate contributions to the vacuum energy, but you always have this residual uncertainty, which is that the vacuum energy coming from the very highest energy modes that you can't calculate, given only the modes that you see at low energy, was a contribution as well. And that was possibly the dominant one, because the vacuum energy tended to go like the as a positive power of the mass of the particle that you were looking at the modes for. And so then there was an uncertainty. It seemed likely that you could get large contributions to the vacuum energy from high energies. But the story would have been that if you did have a very large contribution coming to you from the integrating out very high energy particles, whatever that large contribution was, it was very, very accurately canceling all the particles that you knew in nature that weren't quite that large, but which were larger than the observed vacuum energy. And there was this incredible cancellation that was happening where they were taking each other out to leave you a small number at very low energy. So nature could work like that, but it seemed weird. But the message was, that was an example where quantum effects could be gravitating, and the surprise was that they weren't gravitating, that the vacuum energy, we think, should be large. The evidence is that there could be a vacuum energy there, but it's much smaller than we think its typical contributions are. So there's an interplay going on there between quantum mechanics and gravity, where the surprise is that the vacuum energy is not gravitating. And probably, if you go out and solve that problem, if I had to point you towards a direction to try and look, it's that the thing that we think is large is not what's being measured. The vacuum energy is the thing we think is large, but what's being measured is curvature, because you're looking at the acceleration of the expansion of the universe, and that's not the same as vacuum energy. And so probably the link between those two things is where the weak part of the argument is. But there was a story there about acceleration, vacuum energy being important for it, and the puzzle of dark energy. And then the whole description of the quantum mechanics of the vacuum energy and how it gravitates led to a discussion of effective field theories, and it led to a discussion of what quantifies the classical approximation, which is actually very nice. It says that we should be expecting classical approximation to be a good approximation in most of the applications we make of gravity, where we're comparing to observations in cosmology or in the solar system. It doesn't mean that there's no problems in quantum gravity, but it tells you where they are. They're short-distance problems and not long-distance problems. And so now, to tie the whole thing together, we're heading towards there is a situation where it looks like quantum fluctuations are gravitating, and that's the story of primordial fluctuations, that we look at the CMB. It's got temperature fluctuations that are present but small, but the puzzle is that the fluctuations are important, but the fact that there's correlations going on large angles in the sky is a puzzle, because those modes were outside the Hubble scale and things weren't doing anything interesting normally outside the Hubble scale. And so the picture for that is that you're looking at vacuum fluctuations, and so I want to sketch how that's working, because it's very similar to the story we've done on dark energy. Although what's missing is how you get from the quantum fluctuations to what's being seen in the sky. So that's mostly what today's about. And I know that those of you that are taking Kendrick's class are seeing a lot of this in more detail. So what you're going to see here is more of a drive-by compared to what he's done, but it's a missing part of this trifecta of puzzles in particle astrophysics. All right, so let's head in that direction. So we're looking for for primordial fluctuations. As vacuum fluctuations. Before getting into the guts of it, I think it's probably fair to say, if you ask for a consensus on primordial fluctuations, there's two things everybody agrees on. One is, so the basic problem is, if you look at space versus time, fluctuations are often, fluctuations are length scales that are things are being stretched on are going typically like the scale factor. But we know that the Hubble scale, the Hubble length, the 1 over h, is also an important scale because we know that when modes are outside of that scale, they tend to be freezing or not doing anything so interesting. So the relative size of those two things is an important thing because if we know that something is on large scales compared to the Hubble scale, it's going to be hard to get fluctuations to do something interesting. If the scale is small compared to the Hubble length, things will oscillate and it'll be kind of classical. It'll be field theory like we're used to seeing it all around us. And so the problem with radiation domination in the universe is that if this is going like t to the 1/2, and h is going like 1 over t, what's happening is that if we plot this length, it's going like h was going 1 over t, so 1 over h is going like t. This is going faster than this is. So if I, so I'm just going to do a sketch here where don't take these curves seriously. I'm drawing straight lines as if it's a log-log plot, but I'm not being so careful. So you should think of this as being like lambda. It's going like t to the 1/2. This is like the Hubble length, which is going like t. And so the problem is that we know that if we have different modes, so this is lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, the whole story that we talked about before, that modes stop doing interesting things when k over a is less than h, is saying that as time goes on, this modes are moving from being longer than the Hubble scale to being shorter than the Hubble scale because this quantity is falling during a radiation domination. And so that means that the larger k's are equal to ah first, and then smaller k's are equal to ah later. So in this picture, lambda 1, k1 would be bigger than k2, and so that means that lambda 1 would be smaller than lambda 2. So the short wavelengths are coming in earlier before the long wavelengths, and that leads to this whole very successful picture of structure formation that small things form first, and then you get bigger and bigger things forming later. The puzzle is, if we look at these scales that are very widely separated in the sky, those are very long wavelengths, and so they basically haven't had a lot of time since they've crossed the Hubble scale. So most of their time they've been out here where things aren't normally doing anything very interesting. And it just seems like that's, if you extrapolate back using radiation domination, they were always out there. So how do you understand these correlations in time? And in particular, why is the correlation in space? And why is the temperature so uniform? That's the puzzle that everybody's trying to solve. And the two things that everybody agrees on are three things, depending on how you count. The first thing is the extrapolation has to be wrong. Everybody agrees on that. So probably it wasn't radiation domination forever. But everyone also agrees that on what you need about how to change about the extrapolation. The problem here is coming because basically this is a falling function. So that means that you're kind of trapped into this world where modes are coming in all the time because AH is falling. What you really need to do is turn AH around and have it grow. So two points of agreement are a pretty much universal agreement. And that means that, as soon as I say that, someone's going to say, oh, no, what about so-and-so? They don't agree with that. And it's true that there might not be that many. There might be the odd outliers, but I think these two points are fairly widely agreed. And tell me if you disagree, if you've heard evidence otherwise, because I think what I'm telling you is not controversial. So the statement is that you need to have AH grow in the past. But AH, H is A dot over A. That's saying you want A dot to grow, which means you want acceleration. So it's very much like the connection to dark energy is coming about because that's the thing that you would need to turn this around and to somehow have this extrapolation change. So that if you could get AH to climb in the past, then these modes that are coming out now would have been, in the past, previously would have been smaller than the Hubble length. And so you can imagine explaining what the physics is that builds in the correlations, having them leave more or less freeze out there and then come back in, and the explanation will all be back here as to what happened. But at least you have some sort of a stage in which you can try and phrase your explanation if you have something like that. And then the way I've drawn it, I've drawn this to be shrinking, the two major options that people take are, if you have to accelerate, what was the velocity before you accelerated? And so the inflationary option would be you were already expanding and now you're expanding even faster. And the bouncing option is that you were contracting and then the acceleration turned you around and so that you're now expanding. So depending on what you think the initial velocity was, this could have been inflation or it could have been a bounce. But basically all the programs are relying on the fact that you've got acceleration doing the good thing for you. And in this picture, the bounce would be where you come down, and then that's how you see that these scales are crossing again. And in the inflationary picture, what happens is that H is pretty much constant during inflation, and then A is going exponentially in time, so that these things are, if this is where inflation ended, these things all kind of drop like a rock. But the logic of the picture is the same in all of them. And I'm going to take you through this one because it's the one that's, I think, the best developed and it's under the best control so far. But that's not to say that that's the way nature worked. So that's the one thing that people agree on. The second thing that people agree on is that in most of these ways that you get acceleration, you're explaining things that happen here in terms of what happened here. And you might think, so now you've got a whole bunch of things that could have been happening here. But what often happens is that this acceleration, it's erasing all the things that you might have hoped to be the explanations for where your fluctuations were coming from. And so that's easiest to see in inflation. Inflation, if momentum modes have a time dependence set by 1 over a, and a is going like e to the ht, then they're dropping like rocks. And so that you have a whole bunch of, supposing someone gives you a bunch of fluctuations in the past during an inflationary epoch, what happens is that inflation irons them out by making them all very flat. And so initial fluctuations tend to wipe themselves away because of the inflation. And so then the question becomes, so why was there anything left to see as your initial primordial fluctuation? And that's where the second point of agreement is that for all these approaches, people agree that although traditionally, most kinds of fluctuations and are being erased by the acceleration of the universe, whatever it was, the thing that survives is quantum fluctuation because it was just always there. The vacuum is just burbling away because it's fluctuating, and it's not being erased because it's the vacuum. And so that's the source of fluctuations, which is just inevitably there, and its amplitude is not changing much. And the fact that its amplitude is not changing much is a good sign because the fluctuations that we see are consistent with being scale invariant. So that's like something which is just sitting there and not doing much. So the second point of agreement is observed primordial fluctuations described by vacuum fluctuations. And so that makes them kind of the point of contact between quantum fluctuations and gravity. Point of contact between observations and quantum fluctuations of gravity. So what I'm trying to do now is to give the cartoon of how that plays out in the inflationary example, because that's the one that's the best developed. But it's true that these are the two paradigms, and that these are the things that there's not a lot of alternates to these on the market. And so you find one that's actually very interesting because it's a whole new direction to think about. So if this is what's going on, the picture is that you've got vacuum fluctuations that are happening always, and at some reason you have some way of calculating what they are here when all the scales of interest are kind of crossing outside the Hubble scale, the Hubble length. And then the argument has to be, how big are they here? What happens to them here? And that's got two parts. What happens to them during inflation when they're outside the Hubble scale? And then what happens to them after inflation when they're outside the Hubble scale? And then the idea is that you're predicting what you see here when they come back into the Hubble scale, and that's where you're starting to measure what the primordial fluctuations are, and you're measuring them there because you know that the modes that came in when the universe was matter dominated, once they came in, they just started to grow again. So whatever they were doing, they grew, and that primordial spectrum you're looking at is the spectrum as a function of k of those modes that entered during matter domination. So let's say that this is the point of equality. So these are the primordial guys, the ones that have come in after matter domination because they were never stopped. The ones that came in here, that crossed the horizon here, these are the ones that had to freeze until matter domination started, and then they started to grow again. So these are the ones that were responsible for, in the power spectrum curve, the ones that are on this side are the ones that are entering here, and the ones that are on this side are the ones that are entering here. And so these ones were stunted and these ones weren't. And so it's the shape of this curve, this part of the curve, which is what you're hoping to predict in terms of what happened back here. So that's the logic of it. Now, part of the story you've done already, which is good because we only have half a lecture left. So this story, the size of the black fluctuations, you worked out in the last tutorial. So vacuum fluctuations in, say, a De Sitter space, although the case you did is more than just a De Sitter space, they were typically, you know, what you found was that for a typical mode, the variance of that mode went, if we had the fields, if we write the field as a sum over modes of A uk of x plus A star uk star of x, then what you essentially showed was that phi squared of k is uk squared. So the variance, the quantum variance, the vacuum is fluctuating. What does that mean? It means that it's a bunch of, the free vacuum is a bunch of harmonic oscillators, and harmonic oscillators, if you're in the vacuum, you're saying that you're in an energy eigenstate, but the field is like position in a harmonic oscillator. And so the field does not take a specific value in the vacuum because it doesn't, the position doesn't commute with Hamiltonian, and the field doesn't commute with Hamiltonian. So it's fluctuating. Its average value was zero in the state that you looked at in the tutorial, but its variance wasn't zero. And the size of this thing was being controlled by the Hubble scale. So if you, it depended on K, but it also was being controlled by the Hubble scale. And the main thing that you found was that for K over A, much less than H, you showed that, and for massless, for the mass equals zero in De Sitter space, you showed that the combination K cubed UK squared was independent of K, essentially. And it basically was proportional to H squared independent of K. So that's your statement of what the properties of the vacuum fluctuations were. So if you're asking, so now what you're looking at when you see the fluctuations come into the horizon, part of the story will be that it started off looking like that. The rest of the story will be it got processed through this period, and you want to know how that processing worked. And there's one important piece of processing that's going to happen. So there's going to be, and that's kind of the main message of the next 15 minutes, is one of the last things you were asked in the tutorial was, if this was really the way things worked, and you wanted to know what's the power spectrum as a function of K, at face value, if the power spectrum was proportional to this, and it's going to basically be proportional to this, I'll make that more precise. So let me make it more precise when we do it. But the logic of the K dependence of things is there's two parts to it. This thing is K independent, but it depends on H. So if we're in De Sitter space and H is a constant, then everything's K independent. But if H was not a constant, and in the example you did in the tutorial, it wasn't a constant because epsilon was a constant, so epsilon was the rate of change of H, then what happens is that this is time dependent, and that effectively becomes a K dependence because what time are you supposed to evaluate this? We're interested in evaluating these fluctuations at the instant where the particular mode crosses the horizon. So for mode number lambda 3, we want to know what h squared was here. But for mode number lambda 1, we want to know what h squared was here. So we're interested in evaluating that at the time when that particular mode crossed the horizon. So we're evaluating the stuff at what they call horizon exit. And that means that time dependence is convertible into k dependence because the time that you're interested in is a k dependent time. So horizon exit is the time when, again, k is equal to ah. So if this is a function of time, then the time that you need is a k-dependent function of time. The time you're evaluating things at depends on k, because this is a criterion that tells you what time you need as a function of k. And so if h is a constant, you don't care. But if h is a time-dependent thing, then what's happening is that if you wanted to know what ddk of this was, it's turning into dd time of this. And so in the tutorial, if you got through to that point, the fact that this is time-dependent means that effectively you're growing a k-dependence which sees the rate of change of h. And so so in the tutorial, you showed that basically k ddk of k cubed u squared, it goes like, you can convert it into a statement about ddt of h, and so it's proportional to epsilon, because that's the thing that is defined to be minus h dot over h squared. And that's that's one of the slow roll parameters. So if this is vanishing, if you're in De Sitter space, this is zero. But if you're not vanishing, then the fact that it's k-dependent is coming about because this is time-dependent, and then you know how things are evolving in time in terms of the slow roll parameters. And so in the tutorial, it says, if that was the whole story, then this would be the answer. And that's not the whole story. And the reason it wasn't the whole story is that there's a part of the story is going to come from how things are being processed. So there's another piece which comes about the processing from here to here introduces us one more piece of time dependence that you're going to want to track. And I know that Kendrick is tracking it in great detail, so I kind of mostly want to give the flavor of the argument. So the thrust of what I want to talk about is how do you process things from here to there and track what's going on. And so to do that, what we're trying to do is we're generating fluctuations because we've generated some variance in the field phi. And a legitimate question you could ask is, we're generating quantum fluctuations, and I'm going to now talk about fluctuations as if we had classical fluctuations. And there's a story there. There's a decoherent story there, which is worth telling, but which I won't tell unless someone asks about it. But so what we're going to do is we're going to track how fluctuations evolve when k over a is much less than h. Now, fluctuations in what? So this whole discussion here was about a scalar field. Why do we want to have a scalar field? Well, we're talking about a scalar field because we needed to have acceleration. And so we know that one way to get an acceleration is to have something like the vacuum dominate the energy. But we don't want it to be the vacuum because we want it to go away at some point. We don't want to be accelerating forever. We want to be accelerating until the time when we start to look like things are now. And so to achieve acceleration in option A, the inflationary option, so what we're going to do is we're going to seek. Remember, what we want is something where the pressure over the energy density is less than minus a third. And when we were talking about dark energy, I showed you that if you had a scalar field, then if it was homogeneous and if phi dot squared over 2 is much less than V, then because the pressure for the system turns out to be 1 half phi dot squared minus V, and the energy density turns out to be 1 half phi dot squared plus V, those together tell you that if this is true, then it'll be true that the pressure over the energy density will be minus 1. Because it's just saying that that's gone away, and then the ratio is just set by V with opposite signs. So,
P by rho.
P by rho, thank you. Yeah. And so the vacuum energy was an extreme example of that, where all you had was a constant, and so this was just minus rho. But for a scalar field, if you imagine that the potential is very flat, then you can imagine that that you're close to a vacuum energy, but you're not exactly there. And so because you're slowly rolling down some hill, kinetic energy will be slow, small compared to V. As long as that's true, the universe will expand, and it'll accelerate in its expansion. And then at some point, you design it so that something dramatic happens, and then you're no longer in this regime where things are expanding, and that'll be how you leave inflation. And that's not an easy thing to do. So getting out of inflation is a whole story in itself. But we're just going to assume that somebody's done that for you, so that somebody's built a model, and it accomplishes those ends. But the reason that I'm telling you about the scalar field is that if we're going to track fluctuations, we have to track those, because those are the things that are driving the energy density, and so that's going to be an important part of the story. So in our fluctuation story, we're looking at a system where we want to track fluctuations in phi and the metric. And what are we trying to get? What we're trying to get in the end of the day is we want to know the power spectrum that's being compared to the CMB. And you remember, the relevant thing there was, so for applications to the CMB, for applications to the CMB, you're not looking at the scalar field that was around in the early universe. You're looking at the potential wells that the dark matter has formed and the light is climbing out of at the moment of last scattering. So you remember that, so if we define recombination as the surface with a fixed temperature, and that would be the temperature where atoms form, then in that picture, the way to see why there's a temperature fluctuation is because the light climbs out of potential wells, gravitational potential wells. And those wells were formed by the dark matter. So what counts is the variations in the potential gravitational potential energy, which I'll call capital phi. Maybe I should call this chi, just so it's not easy to follow on the board. So the issue for making contact between the fluctuations of the scalar to the temperature is you want to make contact between the fluctuations of the scalar and the fluctuations in the gravitational potential. And so this calculation that you did in the tutorial is part of the story, but it can't be the whole story, because this is all about how the scalar field chi fluctuated. It's got nothing to do. It's got nothing to do with directly yet. It doesn't have anything to do with the thing that we really want to know the fluctuations of. And that's the thing that was missing in the story that I was alluding to. So what we want to follow is the argument here is that quantum things are fluctuating with size set by h, but the thing that we're interested in is actually not a propagating degree of freedom that's fluctuating. It's really the Newtonian potential. We want to know how it fluctuates. So we need to know, how does chi mix with phi? So we want to track how chi, delta chi, mixes with delta phi. So to do that, we just need to linearize everybody. And so what we'll do is we'll take our total Lagrangian to be the Einstein-Hilbert one for gravity plus this one, linearize the equations, and go to town. So we'll have delta chi, of course, but then also we'll have a delta metric. So it'll be linearized around the Friedman-Robertson-Walker one. So let me just write down a few of the intermediate steps. So before, I was not doing this relativistically. I was only doing it non-relativistically because we were doing dark matter. And so now this is the This is the complication I was trying to avoid. So if we use a background metric, we use one where probably I'm going to want to use conformal time here. So we're going to have a squared of eta minus d eta squared. Let's just say d space squared. Then this fluctuation will have a Polo factor of a squared out of it. And it has a time-time piece, and it has space-space pieces. And so let's call the time-time piece capital phi. Actually, let's not call it capital phi. Let's call it little phi. There's a thing I'm not going to track. I guess I will track. So the derivative of what I'll call b. This is a space-time piece. And then what I'm writing down is a scalar part of the fluctuation. So we'll have 2 psi delta ij plus di dje. So these are the fluctuations that have the transformation properties of the tensor, which I can build out of scalar quantities. So phi, b, and e, and psi would be the scalar degrees of freedom in the metric. Though later on, we're also going to be interested in the tensor fluctuation, so we could also have the piece which is a tensor fluctuation. So let me put that in here too. So I could have put it in a piece which is symmetric but trace-free piece which is not gradient. So this is the intrinsic spin 2 part of the field. And there's also a spin 1 part, which I'm not writing because it's essentially not going to play any role. So this is the thing that's describing the gravitons. And when you quantize the gravitational field in this background, the thing that will do this will be the gravitons. So there will be a story, which I won't say much about, except in comparing the amplitude of things. But we should expect that that hij, it's going to be the thing that we'll be able to write as a sum over momentum of a sub k times some polarization ij of x plus a star. And this is a k lambda, I guess, so it'll have some polarization index. So all the things that you did for scalar field, you could do for h, and it roughly will be true that the fluctuations in h will be of the order of the Hubble scale squared. So it's when we look at how spin 2 things fluctuate, it's a much more of a straightforward calculation because it's really just directly mimicking what you did for the scalar. But if you're interested in phi, which is the thing that is almost the same as what we're interested in at later times, that part of the story won't go through, and it's these things which are kind of more the gauge degrees of freedom that are not propagating that are interesting, and that's kind of because they're not propagating, they're how they fluctuate. The short version of the story is that if we had just been propagating in some background without a scalar field, then these are the gauge degrees of freedom that you're not going to worry about, and these are the only things that propagate. But what will happen now is that we have a scalar degree of freedom in our problem that is propagating, but it can start to mix with these things, so they can acquire, when chi fluctuates, these things can fluctuate, they can inherit a fluctuation because they're mixing with chi. And they're mixing with chi because they're in a time-dependent background, so that the split between the metric and chi is not a time-independent one. And so the evolution of the background allows these things to mix with the scalar field. So to quantify that, we want to kind of get rid of all the gauge issues. And so you know that at the linearized level, we have general coordinate invariance, and that is that delta chi transforms as a scalar, and the metric does the metric thing. Delta g mu nu is just partial mu c mu. And we want to kind of remove that freedom, and so there's at the linearized level, we can take linear combinations of these fields that are invariant. So the gauge invariant linearized combinations are, that's what capital phi is. So it's that phi minus 1 over a times b minus e prime prime. Prime is the same thing as d d eta, so that's the conformal time. And we have delta chi hat, that'll be the delta chi. minus chi prime b minus epsilon prime. We have capital psi, which is the psi over there, plus a prime over a b minus epsilon prime, and we have the vector one, which I don't care about. So the statement is that if you linearize the field equations, you ask how the fluctuations transform under general coordinate transformations, they transform like this. If I make these combinations, these particular combinations of the fluctuations, and then I ask, how do they transform under these linearized transformations? The answer is they don't. They're invariant.
This mu phi capital phi is the gravitational
potential. Well, strictly speaking, if you didn't, so it's a gauge dependent statement. So you said yes. The short answer is yes, or long answer is yes, short answer is no. So the it's yes because it's the gauge invariant thing. But the reason that you say yes is that it's a thing that I could choose a gauge where it was basically phi. And in that gauge, that's when you think non-relativistically, that's what you're normally thinking, is that G00 is the Newtonian potential. So that's kind of why we think of it as being the analog of the Newtonian potential. But this is being done in a relativistic way. So it's something which is gauge invariant and captures the physics we're looking for. So, but it will be the variations, the fluctuations of that we're going to want to track. And because we've got rid of the gauge, the freedom to redefine things from gauge transformations, we don't. Sorry?
So these
are Mukhanov
variables or
some? Not yet, no. Okay. Now the Mukhanov variable will be a specific combination which is diagonalizing the kinetic term. So this is kind of getting rid of the gauge degrees of freedom, but when you look at, I'm going to write the evolution equations and they're going to mix with each other still, and Mukhanov's variables are the ones that diagonalize that. So far, so good. So now the plan is, and this is the algebra part, this is why I'm just quoting you answers, is that, so what you do now is like, from here on in, you don't need to be an imaginative physicist, you need to be a good accountant, right? You just have to have, you've got an action, you expand it out to, you write the field equations out to linear order in the fields, because that's easier than expanding the action to quadratic order. And then you take those field equations, you've got them now in terms of all these variables, like phi, b, and everything. Then you do the change of variables to these things, and nothing's left over because that's the statement that things were gauge invariant. And so in the end of the day, there's a set of linear equations that these things satisfy, which we can express the linearized field equations, which is the Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equations, in terms of linear equations for those guys. And I just want to write down what the two important ones are for us. But be clear that what's being done here is we're linearizing the Einstein tensor, and we're linearizing the stress energy tensor for the scalar field in the Einstein equation. So the linearized field equations for those variables are, so for H, the tensor modes, it's simple. It's just kind of the one you would have expected, probably. It's k squared over a squared. So that just looks like the kind of fluctuations we had for a scalar field. So all your intuition here is exactly the intuition we've had before. So this is for the tensor modes. And then for the scalar modes, it's so delta, what did I call it? Delta chi hat. Dot, dot, 3h, delta chi hat dot, plus k squared over a squared, delta chi hat. So this part of it you're kind of expecting to see because that's the Klein-Gordon part of it. But then there's the stuff that now mixes with the metric coming from. So this is b prime of chi delta chi hat minus 4. Chi dot capital phi dot plus 2 v prime of chi. And then we also have one of the Einstein equations is phi is equal to chi dot right. So this is just turning the crank. And then the smart way to write these equations is the Mukunov way, because you can see that delta chi is mixing with phi, and it's mixing because of the fact that we've got a time-dependent background, and it's time-dependent because we're not at the minimum of the potential. So if you didn't have that happening, then if you'd have been in a static space-time, then the story that I told you before about the scalar field does what it wants to do, and here's the Klein-Gordon equation, would have been true, but it's being ruined because we're not doing it around a static background, and that's the why we get mixing between phi and chi. And then the counterpart of that is that the phi equation, which is not second order because it's not a propagating degree of freedom, acquires a source term which sees delta chi again because of the fact that the time dependence of the background. So the fancy way to do this is to diagonalize things with the Mukunov variable, and I'll mention that in a second again. But there's a brute force way to do this, and let's do the part before inflation ended where let's specialize to the case where k over a is much less than h, and inflation is still happening. And because in that case, you know that the kinetic terms are very small compared to the potential terms, and so we can start dropping some of the highest derivatives. So that means that we can think of it as being in a slow roll, and that means what we'll do is we'll drop the delta chi hat dot dot term, and we'll drop the, let me make sure I say them all, because it's going to, we'll get rid of the background chi dot dot term. So we're dropping the highest time derivative of everybody. So that's this term. The background fields satisfy the usual thing. We know that the background satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation, chi dot dot plus 3h chi dot plus v prime is equal to 0. And then the Friedman equation, h squared, 3h squared is equal to 1 over m Planck squared times rho. And rho is 1 half chi dot squared plus v. So those are the things we use whenever we see something like this. So in the background equation, we're dropping that. In the fluctuation equation, we're going to drop that. And the leading time derivative for phi is the first derivative term, so we'll drop that too. So let's drop that. And then since k over a is small, we'll drop that. And I think I'm probably going to drop this one too because the mass is going to be small. So m squared, which is v prime. So I might drop that. So effectively, we've got this, this, and this, and these two terms. So that gives us the approximate system, 3h delta chi hat dot plus, oh, I lied to you. I'm going to keep that. Sorry, I was moving too fast there. V prime prime of chi delta chi hat plus 2v prime of chi delta, capital phi is 0. So I've just basically written that equation, and then the second equation is becoming 2m Planck squared h capital phi is chi dot delta chi hat. So those are second order equations in time, or they were second order, now they're first order equations in time. And so this thing had two solutions, and typically you remember there was one that was maybe stationary, maybe growing, maybe falling fairly slowly, and then there's another one that's falling faster. So these approximations and the slow roll approximation, what we're doing is we're getting rid of the fast one. So the one that's dropping the fastest, we're eliminating. And because we now only have one mode left, the first order equation is sufficient to capture the slow roll guy because you needed one less integration constant because the missing integration constant was saying, don't keep the fast roll guy, the one that's dropping fast. Now it happens that this looks complicated, but there's the solution you can write down by inspection. So the solution is, so this is the solution that's not dropping quickly in that equation. So it's delta chi hat. I'll put the momentum label back in again. It's some constant, which could have depended on k, times v prime of chi over v of chi. And then capital phi, which I'll put in a momentum label k, is minus the same constant over 2 times v prime of chi over v of chi squared. Claim is you plug that into that, and you get 0. And you can kind of see why, because it's just designed to pick off the, for example, this will be if we use this, and for things like chi dot, we have to use the slow roll version of this thing. So chi dot will trade for 3h chi dot, we can think of as being minus v prime. And so you can kind of see that if I write this as 3h, or this is v prime over 3h, then I can bring the h over here, the 3h over here, I'll have 3h squared. 3h squared was v, essentially, if I drop that. So slow roll means that I'm neglecting the kinetic term compared to the potential term. And so it's when I use this equation with these equations that you see that these equations are satisfied. So this is telling you how things evolve. It says that delta chi is not fixed, but it's evolving in a way which is completely controlled by what the background does. So let's use the initial condition, because what we're interested in is how did things evolve from horizon exit till the point inflation ended? And this is telling you the answer to that. So what we'll do is we'll say that the initial condition we'll use at horizon exit is that delta chi hat at horizon exit is the mode function uk at horizon exit. This is the thing that we've calculated before. That'll ensure that delta chi hat k squared will be uk squared, and that's what the variance of the field should have been. So this is a classical perturbation that would have captured the same variance as the quantum fluctuations had. And with that initial condition, we can read off what c is. This gives c sub k, and then we can plug that into phi, and we're going to get that phi k at the end of inflation. It'll be given by blah, 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 blah. So there's some numbers here which are not so important, but there's a piece which is uk evaluated at the horizon exit. That's this piece. And then you can kind of see what I'm going to do here is that c is basically delta chi over this at horizon exit. So we're going to get u divided by this at horizon exit. So we're going to get a v over v prime at horizon exit. And then we'll have this factor of squared. So we'll have v prime over v at end of inflation squared. Now, that's all very nice, but more useful is to have that in terms of the potential is not so interesting, but what we would like to have things in terms of is the rate of change of the Hubble scale, like things like epsilon. So to translate these things into the rate of change of the Hubble scale, we'll use that if we take epsilon to be minus h dot over h squared, and we use what the evolution of h is from the Friedmann equation there for the background, this becomes m Planck squared over 2 v prime over v squared. And so I can trade v prime over v for basically epsilon over m Planck squared. And so if I do that here and here, you can kind of see that what I'm going to get is that capital phi is up to a number. It'll be uk at horizon exit. We're going to get a 1 over, we're going to get an m, 1 over m Planck squared, and then we're going to get an m Planck, so we're going to get a total of over m Planck. And then we're going to have, that's the 1 over the square root of epsilon at horizon exit, and this is epsilon at the end of inflation. So if we're trying to track epsilon at the end of the inflation is not small. This could be order one, basically, because that's epsilon being small is saying that your evolution is slow and then you're dominated by the vacuum. But this is the thing, epsilon, this says epsilon is a small epsilon. And so this shows you that if you wanted to know what, and I know that you can't see this very well, so let me raise this. Let me switch. If I wanted to calculate the power spectrum for phi, which is what we do want to calculate, that's going to go like it'll be proportional to, let me write it, the power spectrum for phi, for capital phi as a function of k. That was just the thing that was the Fourier transform of delta phi, delta phi. It was the thing that was basically given by capital phi squared. If you remember from that class when I derived the power spectrum, that's the way that it was related to the modes of the field. So plugging this in, this is U sub k at horizon exit. Let me just write it as U sub k squared divided by M Planck squared, epsilon at horizon exit times factors that are not varying at different, I'm just tracking the factors that care about when horizon exit happened, because that's the thing that was momentum dependent. So in that, where the vertical lines cross the horizontal line during inflation, that's telling us the k-dependence of things. So that's where we want to know the time dependence very accurately. At horizon, at the end of inflation, it just ends all at once, and it does it for all k, so it's not really a k-dependence to track. So this is the key formula. And I told you that when you calculate the fluctuations, there's a factor of k cubed that appeared in the in that power spectrum for phi, and that was, if you remember why that was happening, let me just I just want to connect the dots to the formulas we've been using. So remember that in position space, phi of x plus x prime, phi of x prime, the average is over x prime. That was the thing that was the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed times the power spectrum of k e to the I k dot x. That was the definition of p. So if we just plug in the Fourier modes for this, that's where that formula said that that's why p of phi is basically the Fourier mode for k squared. That's where that came from. But the thing that was that you actually measure the way the reason that there's a k cubed up there is that what we're, if we did the integrals over k here, you can write this as the angular part will be a 4 pi, so we'll have a 1 over 2 pi squared, integral of k squared dk, 0 to infinity, of p of k sine k r over kr. We do the angular integral because there's a cosine buried in there. And so if you write this in a scale invariant way, so it's dk over k, then there's a factor of k cubed that would go here, and I'll write that 2 pi squared here too. And that's what we called delta squared of phi. That's the thing that if things were scale invariant, the k's would cancel here, the k's would cancel here, you'd think the k, this should be the thing that would be k independent. That was why it was useful to think about. So this is the thing that is going like k squared, k cubed, p phi of k. And then from over there, that's the thing that's going like k cubed, uk squared over m Planck squared, epsilon, the horizon exit. And this is the thing that you saw was essentially h squared. So what we're supposed to do for this power spectrum is we're supposed to read off h squared divided by m Planck squared. In the tutorial, if that had been the whole story, the rate of change of this, the k dependence of this would have come from the fact that h was time dependent. And so it would have seen the derivative of h, which would have given you, if you thought of p, if you thought of delta, actually what I want to say if p, delta phi, it's well described by a power law. And so if I take k ddk of this, that'll be what picks off the power law. And if that factor had not been there, what would have happened is that you would have just picked off the ddk of h is the same thing as ddt of h, and you would have picked off a factor of epsilon. And so you would have expected to find, or if you just to do ddk of this, I get ns minus 1. You'd expect to find ns minus 1 is proportional to epsilon with some number. The number was minus 6 or something like that. And that was not quite the whole story because it misses this. Because if h is time dependent, in general, epsilon is time dependent, and the rate of change of epsilon will also contribute. And that's why the normal formula, if we take k ddk of delta phi squared, that's the thing which is ns minus 1. And it's normally given by a formula which I can't remember the numbers. It's some number times epsilon plus some number times eta, where eta is epsilon dot over h epsilon. So it's the rate of change of epsilon. And your homework assignment would have given you this fine, but it would have missed this because it didn't see this. And that came from the evolution to the end of inflation from horizon exit. We haven't talked about what happens from the end of inflation until horizon reentry. Does more stuff happen? The answer is no. And the simplest way to see that is also an independent way of understanding this factor of 1 over root epsilon. And that is that, and this is my last thought, and then we're done. So is there more K dependence coming after inflation ends? After horizon reentry, we know what happens. Things just grow because that's the story we talked about before for structure formation. And the important thing is for single field models, what you can prove is that this quantity, there's the curvature perturbation called zeta, which is defined in terms of these other variables as capital phi plus 2/3 capital phi plus capital phi dot over h over 1 plus w. 1 plus w is, again, p over rho for whatever the source was for your metric. So this is not specifically for scalar field. This is you have a fluid, and you're coupled to the Einstein equations. The statement is that this thing, if k over a goes to 0, so it's outside the Hubble scale, then zeta dot times 1 plus w is equal to 0 is what the equation of motion for zeta is. So you construct this quantity, you take the linearized equations for phi, you just turn the crank, and you get an answer which is zeta dot times 1 plus w is equal to stuff involving spatial derivatives of things. So as k goes to 0, they all go away. So this shows you that the curvature perturbation, this specific quantity, is conserved as long as you're well outside the horizon. And so the nice thing is that this phi dot is kind of annoying, but this is such a general expression. If you go through, the phi dot is there because if you go through, say, inflation ends and then the equation of state changes, and then maybe you go from radiation dominated to matter domination, so the equation of state changes again. The important thing is that this formula does not assume that W is a constant. So it does not assume W equals constant. So you can trust this formula as you go from inflation to post-inflation to radiation domination to matter domination. And what happens when you go through the transitions between those two things is that there's transients. So your phi dot starts to change. But if you go kind of well away from the transients, there's always the Hubble damping damps the phi dot away. So this is always there to make the thing constant. But if you go well away from the transitions, this has been negligible because it damps away. And so then effectively what happens is that the phi plus 2/3 phi over 1 plus w is conserved. If you look deep in the inflationary regime and deep in the radiation dominating regime, it has the same value. And since you know how w changes in those two things, 1 plus w is basically epsilon in the slow roll inflationary regime, and it's whatever it is in radiation or matter domination. You can kind of read off exactly how this thing changes. And it's telling you essentially directly how to relate the curvature perturbation and so also phi fluctuations at horizon reentry to what left during horizon exit. The important thing that went into this was that you had one fluid. So W was not constant, but it was only one fluid. So the way to ruin this prediction would be if you have several scalar fields or you have multiple components to your source and gravity, then you can transfer things back and forth between those fluids, and that can be the kind of thing that can make zeta start to evolve a little bit. But for a single scalar field or a single component dominating the universe, it's the conservation of zeta that's the thing that is so powerful, because it says that you're not really sensitive much to what's going on between horizon exit and horizon reentry in this class of models. Because although the equation of state can change, this combination, this plus this, is essentially not changing. And so if you learn what this is at horizon exit, which you know from the fluctuations of the quantum fluctuations, then you essentially can read off what the thing is you want to know at horizon reentry. So the goal there was, this is the way that you make contact between quantum fluctuations for the scalar field and the thing that's observable, which is the fluctuations in the gravitational potentials, which are essentially the fluctuations in temperature. For comparison, the story for tensor modes was really easy, was much easier, because the complication was really that you were always getting h squared, the mode divided by m Planck squared turned into h squared over m Planck squared. That's kind of what fluctuations do. The quantum fluctuations are going like h squared, and you're comparing them when you gravitate to the Planck scale. The thing that was unusual here was that you got this factor of epsilon because of the fact you had to mix with the gravitational potential. But for tensor modes, you don't have to mix. They're there, they fluctuate, you get this factor of h squared over m Planck squared without that. And so for tensor modes, for hij, it's just proportional to h squared over m Planck squared. And that's why the ratio between the scalar modes and the tensor modes, let's call this t, that's what they call r. And that turns out to be basically it's proportional to, this is going like 1 over epsilon, this is going like without 1 over epsilon, this is proportional to epsilon. And it turns out that in the conventional normalization, it's 16 times epsilon. And that epsilon is there because this was doing the standard h squared over m Planck squared thing, and this one had this funny factor because of the fact you had to mix the scalar over to the Newtonian potential. And at present, what seems to be true is that ns minus 1 is like 0.96 or something like that. So that was the thing that was 1 minus some number times epsilon, some number times eta. And so we have an upper limit. This is less than about 0.1. And so these two things are telling you what epsilon and eta are if you compare it to the primordial spectrum of fluctuations. And that's nice. But if you saw these tensor modes, then you'd have an interesting statement, because the rate of change of the tensor modes, if you did kddk of this, they should also be going like k to a power, which we could call n sub t. And the rate of change of this is only going to see epsilon, because it's going to see the rate of change of h. So the story that I gave you before, the naive story, would have applied there. And so we'd have a prediction that n sub t would be proportional to epsilon with some number, I can't remember what it is, it's 2 or something like that. And so then you have four observables. You'd have the amplitude of the scalar fluctuations, the thing that's in front of this, like a sub tensor. You'd have the amplitude of the tensor fluctuations, and you'd have the index, spectral index for both. And you have three numbers to describe them with, which are epsilon, eta, and the Hubble scale. And so then there's a prediction. So there's a prediction is that n sub t should be correlated with r in a way which doesn't depend on anything else. And right now, unfortunately, we're not in a place where we can do that. But that would be the holy grail of these kind of models. And the logic of it was the acceleration that you need erases, it kind of is the thing that wipes the canvas clean. And then the vacuum is just there, and it gives you the quantum fluctuations, the Jackson Pollock picture of the on the canvas. And then the acceleration expands it across the sky, and that's what you're looking at. So it's if it's true, so far it seems to do a good job of describing what's seen, then you're looking at, for the first time, quantum fluctuations that gravitated, which would be enormously cool. And it relied on the fact that h over m Planck was much less than 1. It gave you an effect that you could measure, but you believed it because the quantum corrections were not out of control. So that's a good place to cut it off.
It's a tradition to induct you to a very special talk. Thank you for this excellent talk.
That's great.
You have a different color.
If you